got a sprain or an itch, pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. There are two different roads to go down to explain why getting the vaccine is difficult against some viruses, easier against others, and almost impossible against several. Polio, smallpox, hepatitis A and B are all serious viruses for which we have found answers. Even the flu, which can shift and mutate each year, has a vaccine. Unfortunately, there's no remedy for the lowly cold.
They have tried since the early 1950s. It was just after researchers discovered the rhinoviruses that caused the common cold. This group together accounts for up to 75% of colds in adults.
The problem with the rhinovirus is the number of circulating strains. That's because there are at least 160 different strains of rhinovirus. The scientists have found that it just is incredibly difficult to create a vaccine or drug, for that matter, that will target all of those 160 strains.
The early work done in the mid-20th century showed simple vaccine could immunize people against one strain, but not dozens or even hundreds of vaccines for one illness. Number one, it would be difficult, and number two, it would be very costly.
Researchers are now trying to find some part of the viral structure that's shared between all 160 serotypes. Now, if they can successfully target an immune response against that common structure, then they could conceivably design a single vaccine that would offer protection against every strain of rhinovirus. This is not yet, of course, an option.
Remember that the polio vaccine consisted of all three polio viral serotypes, and the vaccine created against pneumonia has components from 23 different bacterial strains.
One goal is to create a vaccine mix of at least 80 strains, covering the group of rhinovirus serotypes that are the most common and the most virulent. Let's now talk a bit about the flu virus. The serums created decades ago are still effective against their specific rhinovirus strains today. Each new serotype added to the mix costs a significant amount of money, and it really adds complexity to the formula. Again, not easy to do, and it costs, say the secret word, M-O-N-E-Y, money.
But even if the researchers could discover a cure for the cold, it probably won't be made available to healthy people who shrug the cold off in 3 to 4 days.
As a matter of fact, an actual cure might not even be that useful because most people are already recovering by the time they're able to see a doctor. Not only that, you would need to test to see if you even had rhinovirus rather than some unrelated virus that causes identical symptoms such as human coronavirus or adenovirus.
Getting back to the coronavirus, specifically COVID-19, we know that there is an incredible variability of coronaviruses, and they can be responsible for the common cold as well as many other infections.
Remember SARS and MERS? The coronavirus adapts and evolves and becomes even more effective at infecting hosts without ever being defeated by the immune system. Now, we've all seen that graphic picture of the coronavirus with all its spikes. These viruses have a high potential mortality rate. Now, both SARS and MERS are caused by coronaviruses, just as is the COVID-19. The question is, how do they adapt to new environments? This seems to be due in part to the spikes on the surface of the virus. Now, these spikes are basically proteins called S-proteins, jutting out from the surface of the virus itself. Now, the S stands for spike.
One part of the spike apparently allows the virus to attach itself to host cells. That's great for the virus. A part of the spike is called the receptor binding domain, or RBD for short.
Now, it's this RBD, the receptor binding domain, that initiates the interaction between the host cell and the virus. And it is essential for infection.
The bad thing, at least for the virus, is the fact that RBDs are targeted by antibodies that neutralize the virus and allow the immune system to flush it out of the host system. That's not good for the virus. They would be annihilated.
But wait, they can't infect cells without an RBD, which needs to be exposed so that it can basically latch onto the host cells. But the RBD needs to be masked to avoid being targeted by antibodies. So what's a poor coronavirus to do? Well, what it does, or has done, is develop a mechanism that helps it survive and thrive.
Let's look just a little more deeply at the RBD. It is made of three parts, and even then, the RBDs vary widely between strains. It is because of this variation that antibodies are unable to detect the new strains.
So the RBDs not only retain and may even improve on their affinity for the target cell, they also alternate between visible and masked states.
By observing the RBDs structure up close, the research team was able to identify the three long loops that latch onto the APN. As analysis of these viruses over the last 50 years have shown, these loops are virtually the only thing that varies from one strain to the next.
The experiments demonstrate that the changes observed in the loops modulate an RBD's affinity with APN. Well, that stands for aminopeptidase N, which just happens to be the host cell protein that the RBD latches onto.
The variants that have the greatest affinity are also likely to be better at infecting host cells, which helps them spread.
Six different classes of HCoV-229E have actually popped up over the years, each with a greater RBD-APN affinity than the last.
Now, even with all that said, a vaccine against the common cold may still be possible.
Mice and monkeys both build up immunity to many strains of a virus that causes the common cold after they were given experimental vaccines.
Just recently, researchers created two versions of a rhinovirus vaccine and tested one version in mice and one version in monkeys.
You know, I call these the M&M tests, you know, mice and monkeys. When an animal in the study was given the vaccine, those animals produced antibodies that were specific to all of the strains of the rhinovirus that were present in the vaccine, according at least to that particular study.
Antibodies act as the soldiers for the immune system, and it is the way our bodies, along with the bodies of the M&Ms, respond to foreign invaders like viruses and bacteria.
The body, once invaded, produces these antibodies specific to the individual invaders. Luckily, the body remembers them, and that's how vaccines work. They prompt the body to create certain antibodies so that if a person does encounter a specific virus or bacteria that they were vaccinated against, the immune system can quickly supply those antibodies again and again. As many of us are well aware, vaccines may contain either a weakened or even a dead version of a virus or bacterium. But again, the problem is that the common cold isn't caused by one single virus. Rather, there are countless strains that can make a person sick.
To counteract the variety of rhinoviruses, the researchers added 25 strains to their mouse vaccine and 50 strains to their monkey vaccine. In contrast to this, a recent flu vaccine that was made contained just four strains.
But the mice produced 25 types of antibodies, each unique to the strains in the vaccine. In the same way, the monkeys produced 50 types of antibodies.
What the researchers did was to isolate these particular antibodies from the animal's blood and tested them in additional lab experiments.
Lo and behold, the antibodies were able to prevent the virus from infecting human cells in the petri dishes. Now, that's called in vitro. There have been many successes in the past in vitro, but what we need is in vivo, meaning success in actual humans. So obviously, the next step would be to test the vaccine in humans.
Industry to continue this research, there has to be some profit to overpower the financial risk for companies. Let's see who decides to do the in vivo studies.
Well, so much for the common cold. Let's get back to the theme of the week, maybe even the century, the COVID-19 virus pandemic. There have been many across the country and other countries that have been, well, protesting the governmental orders of closing businesses and social distancing. Many of these just consider it an, let's call it an infraction of our basic human rights. Others feel that it's just a hoax. Well, whatever is your opinion, I'd really like to discuss the other side of the coin for taking on the COVID-19 pandemic, and really any pandemic in the future, and that is something called herd immunity. That's H-E-R-D. The real question is whether, without a vaccine, will herd immunity be effective or won't it save us?
Most people understand immunity to mean that once a person has been exposed to a disease, they can't get it again. It's an easy concept to grasp, and some people have hoped that widespread immunity could be the way out to this pandemic.
If enough of the population becomes immune to the disease, the spread would be stopped, since the virus would run out of new susceptible targets. The herd of immune people would protect everyone. It can be defined as community immunity, if you don't like the term herd immunity, when a large part of the population of an area is immune to a specific disease. So if enough people are resistant to the cause of the disease, then the virus or bacteria, well, it has nowhere to go.
While not every single individual may be immune, the group as a whole has protection. This is because there are fewer high-risk people overall. The infection rates drop and the disease peters out.
Herd immunity may protect at-risk populations, such as babies and those whose immune systems are weak and can't get resistance of their own.
There are two ways this can happen. You can develop resistance naturally when your body is exposed to a virus or bacteria. It makes antibodies to fight off the infection. When you recover, your body keeps these antibodies. Then your body will defend against another infection.
This, in fact, is what stopped the Zika virus outbreak in Brazil. By 2 years after the beginning of the outbreak, around two-thirds of the population had exposure to the virus. The researchers think that the community reached what's called the right level for herd immunity. Another way to get herd immunity is through vaccines. That is indeed what so many researchers are doing today, trying to create a perfect vaccine. We just said that some researchers consider that at about two-thirds of the population, that was really the right level for herd immunity to work. Well, how do they figure that out? In other words, when does a community really reach herd immunity?
It depends on a number called the reproduction number, or R0. The R0 tells you the average number of people that a single person with the virus can infect if those people aren't already immune. The higher the R0, the more people need to be resistant to reach herd immunity.
Researchers think that the R0 for COVID-19 is between 2 and 3. This means that one person can infect 2 to 3 other people. It also means that 50 to 67% of the population would need to be resistant before herd immunity kicks in and the infection rate starts to go down, just like Zika virus did.
One of the problems that we face now has also given this particular virus its original name, the novel coronavirus. Here, novel means new. And it is the fact that it is new that makes it so difficult for herd immunity to work now.
Being new means that it hasn't infected humans before, and everyone is at risk of infection. There's no existing immunity to build on. Early research shows that you can't get the infection more than once. Are we sure? Maybe.
This is important for lasting herd immunity. But since this virus is so new, more research is needed. With no vaccine to protect against COVID-19 yet, a large number of people would need to catch the virus, get sick, and recover before we can have herd immunity.
But getting to herd immunity without a vaccine isn't quite as simple as the idea itself. A number of variables can affect when herd immunity is reached and what it costs to get there. And then, well, these vary depending on the disease. So here are the factors on which herd immunity depends. First, how infectious is the disease? Then, how deadly is it?
And finally, how long do people stay immune once they have gotten it? Changing any of these variables can drastically change the outcome of this equation.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 33 years.
We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburgh Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. You know, at the end of the first half of the show, Carmen and I just began to talk about something called herd immunity. And for the rest of the show, we'll probably be talking a bit more about it and explaining it and seeing just how well it could work in the case of coronavirus. Now, in the 1960s, I was very much into a magazine called Scientific American, especially one column written by a man pretty famous by the name of Martin Gardner, and he wrote a column called Mathematical Games and Diversions. In it, I learned a very nice technique of simplifying virtually any problem to its basic essentials in order to understand it. So I learned some of the basics of actually playing chess using just two chess pieces and a 3x3 chessboard.
Anyway, you can learn about statistics often by using, as an example, a very small quantity. In this example, we are going to follow a fictitious viral disease called COVID-19.
Let's take, for example, this disease with the R0 of 3, meaning that the average number of people a contagious person will infect when no one is immune and no effort has been made to stop the spread of the virus. Also, let's assume that the death rate is, just 1%. And the number of days after immunity, after a person has contracted the virus, is 1,000, just under 3 years. The more people a person with this disease, which we'll call COVID-19, infects on average, the higher the herd immunity threshold rises. But the faster spread also means that the threshold is reached more quickly. That, of course, can lead to a huge portion of the population getting ill all at once, which would, simply overwhelm hospitals, as it did here in the United States. Unless the death rate is extremely low, that would be a devastating mix.
A disease that doesn't spread as readily will stick around for longer, but it helps maintain a flatter curve.
If you shorten the immunity duration, you will notice that the number of people susceptible rises again, even after the herd immunity threshold has been crossed. That's because if immunity fades while the disease is still active, people who were previously immune once again become at risk for infection. Herd immunity only truly works while the recovered population has immunity to the disease.
For COVID-19, of course, we can't change these variables, and we still haven't nailed down their exact values. Anyway, what we do know now, so far, paints a stark picture.
What's going against COVID-19 for herd immunity to work are the following factors. First, COVID-19 is just too deadly, too contagious, and too new to depend on post-infection immunity, as opposed, of course, to immunity via vaccination as a solution. So we could say that acquired herd immunity is not the answer, but vaccines are. We can all assume that if everyone in a population is immune to an infection, it simply can't spread.
But we can still prevent a disease's spread even without everyone being immune if enough people are immune. The more people who are immune, the more likely it is that infectious people will only come into contact with people who cannot be infected, ending the spread.
The problem that the researchers have now, in order to reach even the lower end of that R0 range, would literally be giving up any interventions and just letting the disease run its course. 230 million Americans would eventually become infected, and depending on the fatality rate, more than on the latter. More on that later, hopefully. Millions could die.
And reaching herd immunity, as the outbreak is raging is a completely different scenario than, for example, doing so after a vaccine has been created.
With a vaccine, you can immunize people before they've encountered the virus. So by the time the virus gets to a vaccinated population, it's got nowhere to spread. But in an active outbreak, even once the herd immunity threshold is reached, the infection just keeps going. It takes time for the spread of the disease to crest, because for a while at least, many contagious people will each still infect a small number of vulnerable people, which means even more people will get sick and die.
That phenomenon is called overshoot. The disease sort of stops increasing at the point when you reach herd immunity, but there is still lots of people infected.
It only slowly goes down, and on its way down, it infects another third of the population. Since the new coronavirus is highly contagious, and by that we mean a large percentage of the population would have to get it to slow its spread, the human toll of reaching herd immunity without a vaccine would simply be staggering. And that's assuming that once a person gets sick, they stay immune for a long time. But at this point, we don't even know if that's the case.
Typically, when we encounter a new pathogen, our immune system mounts a defense that includes producing antibodies to fight off the infection.
Afterwards, some of those antibodies and immune cells, well, they hang around, allowing our body to remember the offending microbe and more easily fend it off in the future.
Our immune system has developed immunity to the vast majority of anything that you or I have been infected with in our lives.
You know, most think that the presence of antibodies means immunity. But that's just not true. Look at HIV. There happens to be a huge antibody response to HIV, and it's still never able to neutralize the virus. Researchers have begun trying to find out how much protection COVID-19 antibodies give people who've recovered from the disease.
There is also another problem. There is a chance that the immune response from COVID-19 is enough to prevent someone from getting sick again, but not necessarily from getting infected.
This means that they could still be contagious to others. So far, there are no confirmed cases of someone getting COVID-19 twice. Thank God.
You may have heard that some patients tested positive for the virus again weeks after having recovered, but the researchers later realized that the dead virus fragments from the original infection most likely triggered the positive test rather than a second infection.
Now, you may be asking yourself the question, why would we fail to become immune to a disease? Well, first, it could be simply that our body stopped short of completely killing off the virus in the first place, allowing it to lie dormant and reemerge later. This is what actually happens in HIV. Also, the virus could evolve enough that our old antibodies simply won't work anymore, regardless of whether we got them from natural exposure or a vaccine. And that's the case of the flu, where we need yearly vaccines.
A worst-case scenario, the immune response we produce could just fade too quickly, making us susceptible to reinfection almost immediately.
With the new coronavirus, there's not much evidence that either of the first two scenarios is in play. But the third possibility, that our immunity fades quickly, remains an open question, and one we really won't be able to answer until more time has passed. Normally, at the end of the show at this point, I put a little promo for Southside Medical Center. But I'd like to just sing one song for my wife, a belated anniversary song. No music, and this is for her. This is for you, Carmen. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tide that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day is through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you, because you're mine. I walk the line. As sure as night is dark and day is light, I keep you on my mind both day and night. And happiness I've known proves that it's right, because you're mine. I walk the line. You've got a way to keep me on your side. You give me cause for love that I can't hide. For you I know I'd even try to turn the tide, because you're mine.
I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine. I walk the line. Because you're mine. I walk the line.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.